So thank you everybody for coming to this evening's Dhamma talk. And I did read my piece of paper. The subject for this evening is surviving relationships. But before we do, I've got to make sure I survive my relationship with Eng Chai so that he doesn't get angry at me. So are there any announcements to make?
I think you can be assured I won't be angry with you. Okay, good evening, Achan, brothers, sisters, and Dharma. Before we start, I would like to promote Achan Brahm's book. We have three books for sale. Wow. The first one is Opening the Door of Your Heart, okay, in English, and we have the translation in Mandarin. The third book is Happiness Through Meditation, only in English. This book is available outside at 60 ringgit per copy, and the proceeds will go to Achan Brahm's monastery. Oh, Buddhist Society of Western Australia, okay. Perth. I think before we start with the Dhamma talk, I would like to give a brief introduction of Achan, because not everyone here know Achan, because one bring another. So there could be newcomer. Or any newcomer before we waste any time? Oh, yeah. Oh, you got new fans, Achan. Okay. Achan Brahmawamso, or formerly known as Achan Brahm, was born in London in 1951. So next year, Achan will be 60 years old.
Time to retire.
Okay. Achan regarded himself as a Buddhist at the age of 16, after reading a Buddhist book while still at school. He was actually brought up as a Christian. His interest in Buddhism and meditation flourished while studying theoretical physics at Cambridge University. So, after completing his degree and teaching for a year, he traveled to Thailand to become a monk. He was ordained in Bangkok at the age of 23 by the abbot of Wak Saket. He subsequently spent 9 years studying and training in a forest meditation tradition under Venerable Achan Cha. In 1983, he was asked to assist in the establishment of a forest monastery near Perth, Western Australia. Achan Brahm is now the abbot of Bodhiyana Monastery and the spiritual director of Buddhist Society of Western Australia. Now, Triple Gem Center is pleased to present Achan Brahm.
Thank you, Eng Chai. You're the president of the Triple Gem Center? Chairman? The dictator? Anyway, he's the guy behind this retreat. So this evening, every evening here, I'm giving a public talk. And they may seem like worldly subjects, but you should all know one of the great teachings of the Buddha. He said, all I ever teach is suffering and the way out of suffering. And many of you know that marriage is suffering. Which is why I like relationships. They can be a lot of suffering or a lot of happiness for you. And so because of that, I'd love to apply the timeless Buddhist teachings to how you can deal with this part of your life, which is relationships. You know, boys and girls, or sometimes boys and girls, girls and boys, it's very complicated these days. But there it is, we have relationships. But it's not just relationships with your partner, it's also relationships with your children, with your parents, with your friends, with your monks. And also the relationship you have with yourself. And hopefully during this evening, I'll also apply it to the relationship you have with your meditation practice, to actually to take this on a very deep level and to show the same things which keep you in harmony with your partner also keep you in harmony with your own mind. So you can be at peace with yourself rather than always asking for a divorce. For those of you who have been meditating for one day. Some of you already ready for a divorce. You've had enough with your mind and want to run away, but that comes later. But first of all, there is an old saying about the three rings of marriage, which many of you have heard me say before, but there are some newcomers. And so an old saying is, in marriage there are three rings. And the first ring of marriage is the engagement ring. And the second ring of marriage is the wedding ring. And the third ring of marriage is the suffer ring. And the only reason why you laugh is because that is true. And so we try and make sure that we lessen that suffer ring, the third ring of marriage, so that people can live happily and at peace together. And that gives a lot of personal peace of mind to yourself. If you've got a very good relationship in your marriage, it also gives a lot of happiness to your parents and also to your children when they don't see mummy and daddy arguing all the time. And it also gives a lot of happiness to society when we don't have to waste all this time and problems. And where am I going to put this? Here we go. See how mindful I can become during this talk. Any sort of lapse of mindfulness and I'm going to have a wet robe. Actually, I would prefer a table or something, but that's going to be coming. So that when you have harmony in your life, everybody wins. And so it's really important to give a talk like this. So when you come to the Buddhist temple, you don't just learn about Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path every time, which you know already because you read that in a book, but how those great teachings apply to your life to become happier and more peaceful people. And so that you here can have the edge in Malaysia over everybody else. Because you know how, after this talk, to have harmonious relationships. So I've already said the problem is that, you know, there is three rings of marriage. So whenever I do marriage blessings, and I'm very well sought after to do marriage blessings. In fact, as Buddhist monk, this is part of our service. Oh, that's brilliant. Very good. Wise monk. Wise man. So, now, when I call it, you know that sometimes they call it a cradle to grave service. As Buddhist monks, we're much better than that. We give before cradle to after grave service. Before cradle, which means we do chanting when your baby's still in the womb to make sure it's happy. You know, this is actually really weird. I have so many strange stories. One of the strange stories is if one of these mothers over in Australia, she gave birth in hospital, and she was only maybe 2 or 3 days, still in hospital, and the baby was just drinking the milk. You know, the mum was on the bed, sort of half propped up, but basically reclining. And the baby had finished breastfeeding, and the mother just watched the baby, all by itself, sit on her abdomen, cross its legs in full lotus, put one hand over the other and start meditating. And the baby was only 2 or 3 days old. And that's why she told me about it. Ajahn Brahm, what's going on? And I said, I'll keep a name of that baby and make it a monk as soon as it gets old enough. That's obviously a special baby, but it's true. He meditated in full lotus on the mummy's belly just after breastfeeding. So anyhow, there were really some strange things. So we do before birth to after grave. Because after grave, if you have any problem with ghosts, of course that's where you bring the monks in. So we give the whole service, you know, before birth, after birth, and throughout the whole life, you know, just before you die, the funeral service, and if it doesn't work out right, the funeral service, you get us in to sort it out if there's a ghost. And we are the best ghostbusters, as you all know. Anybody else doesn't work, you bring in the monks and we make sure that ghost behaves. But anyway, that's another sort of story. Part of that is that when people get married, and so that's part of our job to do marriage services. Actually, the last time I was in Malaysia, just in Malacca, I went to Malacca to teach at a conference to help out, Keksia Inn Temple with their 90th anniversary, I think it was. And of course, I was there for the weekend. There was a couple of marriages. And so I was very happy to help out with those marriages. But I know that if I don't get it right at that marriage and don't say the correct things, that couple are going to be arguing and arguing and having a terrible time. They always say in the first year of a marriage, the husband listens to the wife. In the second year of marriage, the wife listens to the husband. In the third year of marriage, the neighbors listen to both of them. I think you get the idea. They argue and shout at each other. So we don't want that to happen. So I'm going to make sure that, you know, when I sort of give these blessings, I don't just do chanting, which I don't understand, but give some really good teaching so that make sure that when they do get married, they can live in peace and harmony together. And so one of the first things I teach them is about what the nature of a relationship really is. And the way I do this is like teaching through the way of confusion. Confusion is a great teaching method. Because when you confuse people, people are really looking for what's the solution? Why is he talking this way? People actually pay more attention after they're confused. So I tell them, and I did this on both of those services in Malacca. Every wedding I do the same trick. I look at the bride, first of all. Now, this is the biggest day of her life. She's getting married. And I look at her and say to her, from this day on, you must not think of yourself. You're a married woman now. You have a husband. So from now on, you must not think of yourself. And she always smiles sweetly and nods, yes. Women are like that. Just romantic, much more romantic than their wives sometimes. But anyway, she nods, yes. And then I look at the groom and say, now you're a husband, you've got a wife. You're a married man now. So from this moment on, you should not think of yourself. And usually the man thinks for a few seconds. Before nodding, okay, yes. And then still looking at him, I say, and from this day on, you should never think of her, your wife. From this day on, you must not think of her. And this is called confusion, just like you're confused now. And then I turn my eyes to the bride and say, now from this day on, you must not think of your husband. Not only is she and he confused, the whole family are confused. And they wonder who they've invited to do this special ceremony. And having opened their minds with the way of confusion, then I tell them solution. From this day on, you must never think of yourselves, nor should you think of your partner. From now on, you should only think of us. And then they get it. They realize the mistake in relationships is either being so selfless, you only think of the other person, or selfish, you only think of yourself. And both ways don't work. Both ways will never have a successful ending in your relationship. If you think of yourself selfish, the other partner is excluded. What type of relationship is that? It will never work. And many of you may have been in relationships where one of the persons is only thinking of themselves. And what they can get out of this relationship, of their needs being satisfied. And of course, that's no relationship at all. It is selfish. It is not Buddhist. It's not compassionate. It's not wise. And the other way of having a relationship is also not compassionate and wise. When you sacrifice yourself for your partner. Now, it's usually the case, and it's not always the case, but I think I'm accurate in saying this, and I can say this as a man, it's usually the wife who does the most sacrificing, giving up themselves for their partner. And many of you have been in that situation, and after a while you just get burnt out, there's nothing in it for you, and you realize this is not something wrong with that relationship. When you just sacrifice yourself and you just think of the other person. And of course the solution You've just heard it. It's not about me. It's not about my partner, him or her. It's about us. It's a relationship. We're both in it together. So when it's all about us in a relationship, not about me, him or her, but us, it gives a different perspective on what you're doing. For example, whenever there's a problem in a relationship, whose problem is it? It's never his problem, although a lot of time you say it's his problem. It's not her problem, although that's what you suspect. And it's not my problem. So in a relationship, whose problem is it? Our problem, yeah. And when it's our problem, it means we put forth the effort to solve it together. Because one side can't solve the problem. When there's disharmony, you can't wait for one person to make the solution. And that's a lot of time what happens. They started it, they've got to fix it. And of course, problems like that go on forever. It's always when we think it's somebody else's fault, we have no solutions. Whenever we think it's my fault, we don't have a solution. It always has to be our fault. And if it's our fault, it's we who will make the solution, working together to find out how we can move forward. So when we realize a relationship is all about us, it means we're not blaming somebody else. We're not blaming ourselves. And we all know it's called the blame game. And in the blame game, nobody wins. It always has to be, it's our solution. I'm not going to blame anybody. I'm not going to blame myself. It's all about us. And that takes away a lot of the problems. You know, whenever you want to blame somebody else for the problem, you know that simile which Ajahn Chah said many, many years ago, blaming someone else for the suffering you feel is like having an itch on your head and scratching your bottom. Try it. If you've got an itch on your head and you scratch your bottom, does the itch go away?
No.
No, you get two itches. One in your bottom again now. That's when you blame somebody else. You've got your suffering, and now you blame someone else to cause suffering from them as well. So no, when there's any suffering or any problem, don't blame others, it's us who have to find the solution. And so how do we find the solutions when it's all about us? Number one in a relationship, it's best not to have a problem to begin with. And where do these problems start in a relationship? It's always because I am right and my partner is wrong. How many times in the last week has your partner been wrong and caused all the problems? And you have been right. Have you ever noticed it's always you who are right and your partner was wrong? And if you ask them, your partner's always right, you were wrong. So what's the solution to that? Ajahn Chah once said, I always quote my teacher, he had some wise sayings. You know, if you ever read Ajahn Chah's books, that was not what it was like being one of his students. He would talk for hours and hours and hours. And most of it, and this is with the greatest respect to Ajahn Chah, most of it was rubbish. But every now and again he'd say something which was really profound. And those are the ones which you read in the books. It's been filtered. You're so lucky. I had to sit there for hour after hour listening for something nice. Now you get all the nice bits, you know, with all the other stuff taken away. But you know, it's really worthwhile sometimes, because when he actually did say something profound, it was really, 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 really powerful. And one of the things he always used to say is, whenever you think you're right, you're not correct. And if you're correct, you're not right. That's a beautiful saying, when yes, you're right but not correct, you're correct but not right. And what that really means is a classic relationship story, which is one of the favorite ones. For those of you who come every year or every 6 months to listen to my talks, you can regard these as golden oldies. These stories which you've heard before, but which you love because they're interesting and fascinating and fun. And of course, in relationships, I can't avoid the chicken and duck story. You know that one, and it's a classic. But it's not just for a story for fun. It actually puts into a story this great little teaching of not being right and being correct, or being correct and not right, in such a beautiful way. It actually brings out one of the great secrets of a harmonious relationship, and actually how to survive them, and don't always stand your ground, I'm right and you're wrong, and start an argument. It's just not worth it. I can say that, but the story says it so much more eloquently. Once upon a time, there was a couple living here in KL, and they had a wonderful lunch together, or dinner together. And after dinner, it was a beautiful, cool evening. They said, let's go and have a walk in the park. And so the two of them together had a lovely walk in the park, holding hands in love after a beautiful dinner. And as they were walking in the park, they heard a sound. Quack, quack. Quack, quack. And straight away, the wife said, oh, listen to that, darling. That's a chicken. And the husband said, pardon, what did you say, darling? I said, that's a chicken. And the husband said, darling, chickens don't go quack, quack. Ducks go quack, quack. That went quack, quack. That's a duck. And she said, no, 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 no. That's a chicken. He said, it's not a chicken, it's a duck. They went quack, quack again. See, it's a duck. She said, no, 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 it's a chicken. He said, it's a duck. She said, it's a chicken. He said, it is a duck. D-U-C-K, duck. And then she started to cry. She says, but it's a chicken. Then he had insight. He remembered why he married her. He looked her in the eye as her eyes were going watery. He squeezed her hand and said, darling, I'm sorry. I think you're right. That was a chicken. And she looked into his eyes and squeezed his hand back. Thank you, darling. And the chicken went quack, quack again. And the pair of them continued their walk in peace, in harmony, in love. What a wonderful story that is. And I do change from time to time who says it's a chicken and who says it's a duck. But in that version of the story, who was the wise person? The wise one was the husband. For two reasons. Why get into an argument over whether it's a chicken or whether it's a duck? Is that really worthwhile spoiling a nice evening? And how many times, maybe in your marriage, in your relationship, have you argued over stupid things which are not worth arguing over? So in that version of the story, the husband understood priorities. What was more important? Being right or being in love? Which is more important? It's obvious, being in love and being at peace with your partner was much more important than being right. So it was true. Now that sort of husband, you know, saying it was a duck, he was right, but not correct. So he changed, and he said, okay, if you want to call it a chicken, it's a chicken. Now, isn't that wonderful to have that sort of ability to have the priorities? What's more important in life is a peaceful, harmonious relationship. Because otherwise we have so many arguments, so many divorces, so many problems in life, it's just not worth it. Secondly, that husband was wise for another reason. How many times have you thought you were right and you end up being wrong? Many, many times I thought I was right and I found out afterwards I'd got it wrong. that could have been a chicken. What we call a genetically modified chicken, which goes quack quack. You don't know what scientists are up to these days. They can do anything. So just because it goes quack quack doesn't mean it's a duck, okay? It could have been a chicken. So the wife could have been right. And in that particular case, they had no argument and lived happily and at peace together. Now, I've told that story so many times, and I do tell it in most wedding blessings which I give. And I remember this. It was a Malaysian wife who married to an Australian living in Perth. She was helping at a fundraising ceremony, working really hard. When I came to thank her, she said, no, you don't need to thank Mila. I come to thank you. I said, why? What had I done? And she said, don't you remember you did a blessing on my marriage 6 months ago? I said, oh yeah, I remember that. Don't you remember you told me the story of the chicken and duck? I said, yeah, of course. He said, well, in the first couple of months of my marriage, whenever there was a difference of opinion between me and my husband, I'd try and have an argument, and he would always give in. And after 6 months, or 3 or 4 months, sorry, of this, I got so frustrated, I confronted my husband. I said, look, aren't you interested in our marriage? Aren't you interested in solving the problems? Every time I bring something up, you just agree with me. You know, you're just too passive. What's going on? And this Australian man looked at his wife with a smile and just said the two words, chicken, duck. And she remembered my story. And she said, from that time on, they never had an argument. And she meant it. She said, that story saved our marriage in the most important time, the first few months when we're getting to know each other. I wanted to argue. My husband refused to argue because he realized our love was much more important than being right. And I forgot that story. And I've come here to work hard all day for you, Ajahn Brahm, and your temple because of what you did for our marriage. And that's very sweet. The relationship actually does help when you have some good teachings like chicken and duck story. So please, when you get home and your wife says, you're late, you say, yes, darling, that's right. Totally disarms her. But one of the other things with relationships is there are always going to be difficulties. And very often we don't let those difficulties go, which is a terrible, terrible thing. I know that when people come for counselling, they know having problems with their marriage. And as I do this a lot, you know, one of the reasons why people come to Buddhist monks for marriage counselling, it's not that we've got degrees in counselling or we're psychologists. The main reason they come to me for marriage counselling is because I don't charge them anything. Really good value for money. We're cheap. But anyway, they often come. I will never forget this. This is actually a good story which helps you understand relationships. There was this Thai couple came to see me many years ago. Oh, they still come into our temple. And they were sisters, an elder sister and younger sister. And the elder sister came for counselling first, but they're sitting next to each other because, you know, they knew each other so well. They were sisters and they shared everything together. So the elder sister, she started telling me about the problem she had with her husband. You know, he wasn't really affectionate, she didn't really trust him that much, they were always arguing and stuff. You know, the typical sort of problems which you have when you get married. And so I was giving her advice, like chicken and ducks and all those other stuff which I've just told you. And you know, she was actually, you know, very impressed, but she was still thinking of splitting from her husband. She really wondered whether the relationship was able to be saved. So basically, you know, she wanted to get rid of her husband. And I tried my very best and gave her lots of things to think about. But then I turned around to her sister, because I couldn't spend all day on one without looking after the other. So this is her younger sister, and I asked her what her problem was. And she said that she was single. And she was getting on, she was in her early 30s. And she was worried that she may not find a partner. She really wanted to share her life with somebody else. But every time she went out and found somebody and maybe went out for maybe a month or 2 months, it always fell apart. For some reason she couldn't maintain the relationship. And she wanted to know why. And she was asking for counseling, and basically that she wanted a husband but couldn't find one. And then suddenly I got an insight. I had a solution which could solve both of the problems. I turned around to the elder sister and said, "You've got a husband you don't want." "You're sisters anyway. Your younger sister wants a husband. Swap." It's logical, it's rational. And they didn't want to do that. I can't, to this day I don't understand why. But then I was serious. And I looked at the elder sister and I said, "Madam, you've got what we call in Buddhism husband suffering. It's the sort of suffering you get when you have a husband. Every woman has it to greater and lesser degrees. So when you get married, you have husband suffering. You ask your friends who are also married, and they can empathize with you, because that's what it's like when you get married. You have husband suffering. You men who've got a wife, you've got what we call wife suffering." And you know what that is. So I told her, "Look, if you get rid of your husband, you won't have husband suffering anymore. That problem will be solved. Instead, you'll have what your younger sister has, single woman suffering." The thing is, you can't get out of the suffering. If you get rid of your husband, you just get a different type of suffering. So then they said, "Okay, then we'll become nuns." And I said, "Great, if you become nuns, you won't have husband suffering, you won't have single woman suffering, you'll have nun suffering." Oh, this nun over here. So we always think that if we can change our circumstances, then we won't have any suffering. But no, you just change the flavour of the suffering, that's all. You still have the suffering. So those of you who are very young, you've got young person suffering. You think, "Oh, I just know, when I get my own house and get some money, that I won't have this trouble, I always have to ask my parents for things, I'll be independent." Yeah, at the moment you've got young person suffering. But when you're independent, you've got all these bills to pay and all these worries, you have independent, mature person suffering. And sometimes you think, okay, that when I retire, many of you are getting old now and you think, "Only a few more years and I can retire and I don't have to go to work again." When you go to work, you've got work suffering. And when you retire, retirement suffering. So really, it's not the situation you're in which is important, but it's the relationship you have with that situation. That is important. The relationship you have with your partner. All about us. Now that's important. Whether you're single or whether you're married, whether you're a monk, whether you're young or old, rich or poor, the meaning of life is the relationship you have with your poverty, with your wealth. Nothing more than that. Being wealthy doesn't make you happy. Being poor doesn't make you sad. It depends on your relationship with these things. Because no matter what your finances are, it's all about us and how we can make peace and do the best with what we've got. And you find in life very many examples of poor people who are so happy. Rich people are happy too. You find people who are married, people who are single, are very, very happy. There's also single people, married people who suffer a lot. It shows you it's nothing to do with the state you are in, but everything to do with the relationship you have with that state. What you do with what you've got. And you know you don't have to change things. Just make a job, better job, of the situation you find yourself in. And how can you do that? At the marriages which I were conducting in Malacca, It was actually, one of the people there was actually well known. She was a TV star, Sandri or something. She's got her own TV show? Sandri or something or other? Anyway, she was actually a very strong woman. And much of those stories, you know, she was quite unmoved by. But this story, I told her, just made her eyes go all watery. I'd got to her, got into her emotional world, beyond her defences. I told her that when I was in Thailand, especially in the north of Thailand, I saw a ceremony which was done every New Year, which moved me immensely. And I told this couple on the anniversary of their wedding every year, I want them to do this little ceremony. It's called the forgiveness ceremony. I want them to buy a present for each other. Nothing expensive, but just like a token. And it doesn't matter who goes first, but one of them to go up to their partner, give them the gift, and say, if there's anything which I have done over the past 12 months, by body, by speech or mind, intentional or just by accident, which may have hurt you or irritated you, or if there's anything which I should have done, which I forgot to do, which caused you pain, I forgive. Please give me your forgiveness. I'm sorry. I'm a human being, I make mistakes, but I love you, you're my partner. Please forgive me. And the partner should always give that forgiveness when it's asked for with sincerity. And then it's their turn to give their partner a gift and say to them, darling, if there's anything which I may have done over the last 12 months, deliberately or just unintentionally, which may have hurt you, please forgive me. I'm a human, I make mistakes too. Or if there's something which I should have done, and I failed to do that, and it's caused you hurt, please forgive me back. And do that every year. Because you know in relationships what happens. These irritating little omissions. Most of them, they're not done deliberately. It's just human beings living with human beings. We're imperfect, we fail, we say the wrong things, but a lot of time we don't mean it. But sometimes our partner keeps it, and it festers, and it causes huge amounts of pain, and eventually separation, when we don't trust each other, and we get angry at each other, and eventually we feel that we don't love each other, to the point then we have to separate. So the forgiveness ceremony, when done every 12 months, means that those painful memories don't have a chance to stay inside of our memory. They're taken out once a year and thrown away. And that way, we don't have to linger with the pain of the past. And also every 12 months, it is like we are restating our own frailties, our own vulnerabilities. Yes, we make mistakes, we're being honest about ourselves, and also we're restating our commitment to make this relationship work. That love is more important than being wrong. And so we're doing that ceremony, it actually really helps. So even if you've been married for many, many years, I invite you to try that ceremony as well. If you've been married a long time, you have to buy your partner a very expensive present to make up for a lot of things you may have done. But you know, it's not the type of present, it's just the attitude behind it, which is very, very helpful. So that when we have attitudes like that, it's amazing just how we can actually live with people. You know, I remember years and years ago, there were these two monks, and like monks, you know, sometimes that no, they're not all perfect. These were two young monks, and they're having this argument. And the characters were both very tough guys. One of them was an ex-US Marine who was in the army during the Vietnam War, fighting on the fronts in Vietnam. He actually got shot in the back of the head. which actually that was a good thing for him because it knocked some sense into him. He was a very violent man before. But that's the sort of tough guy he was. You know, and the other guy was this Jewish real estate millionaire from Chicago. And he made a fortune when he was very young and retired when he was about 23. Really very tough and a very successful businessman. And they both ended up being monks. And they both were having this argument and no one was going to back down. Now, nose to nose, shouting at each other, as sometimes you see husband and wives do. And he was actually the ex-US Marine, had this moment of inspiration. Everybody, they told me this, I wasn't there at the time, but people told me they really thought this was going to be a fight. Now monks aren't supposed to do that, but that's what it looked like becoming, that one was going to punch the other. But instead of punching the other, the US Marine, now a monk, went down on the floor and bowed to this Jewish ex-real estate millionaire, bowed and said, "I'm sorry." And his adversary, the ex-Jewish millionaire, started weeping. It's one of those beautiful moments where conflict was solved when it was about to become violent. And after crying, they were seen going back to the monastery with their arms around each other, friends. That's a beautiful way of solving conflict, because we have the humility to ask forgiveness and to have that forgiveness accepted. So if you've done anything wrong, or even if your partner thinks you've done something wrong, don't worry about whether it's right or wrong and who was at fault and who started it. Just get down on your knees and bow to your wife or your husband and say sorry. And if you're the wife and your husband's bowing to you, say, "It's about time, you stupid husband. I've been waiting this long time." No, don't spoil it like that. Just start crying. You go down and bow to your husband too. Go put on the floor, both of you, and just sort of make amends. Because whenever forgiveness is asked, please always give forgiveness. When someone sincerely asks it, honor that humility and that Dhamma, that beauty of someone is saying, "Look, I made a mistake, please forgive me." I know that sometimes people have asked me, "How many times should you forgive? Say it's your husband has committed adultery. How many times should you forgive?" And the answer is always one more time. And I mean that, not as a joke, because I've seen that happen. There's another couple, again, it's a Malaysian girl who married a Westerner. And the relationship was getting on the rocks, especially when she found out that he was visiting the brothel and not her. She found out, and so they came to me for counselling. And you could see that, you know, the husband, he wasn't perfect, but he was a decent man, a reasonably good man. He just, you know, got lost. And she was a good girl. And so when you're a counsellor, you see these things, you think, how can these two people not get on together? It's a beautiful girl and a beautiful guy. Why can't they live together? And so you get people to look at their goodness, focus on their goodness, not their faults, and got them back together again. She forgave him. He promised in front of me, in front of the Buddha, never, ever, ever to do that again. And he's kept that promise, and they come to our monastery every week out of gratitude for saving their marriage. So it does actually work, forgiveness. And you can always forgive one more thing. And now that woman is very, very happy. She's got a husband she really trusts. She had to sacrifice a lot of her hurt, but she's made it work. And a very, very happy woman. It's really worthwhile forgiving, because the past is done, you can't change that. But forgiveness is an investment in your future and your happiness. So it's well worthwhile. And I see that in their smiles and the fact that she comes all the time. But so that's the relationship we have with a partner. Relationship we have with your kids as well. I was talking about that a couple of days ago. Last night, not a couple of days ago. But you know, one of the interesting things I found about your relationship with your children is that sometimes your children don't tell you what's really going on inside. Maybe at school they're not doing so well. Maybe they're getting into trouble with some bad people. You know why they don't tell you? Because they're afraid of you. They're afraid they may get scolded or punished. And a lot of times the relationship you have with children is one where the child feels afraid. You care, but you don't care with wisdom enough. What I mean is that why is it your child is afraid to tell you what they're doing? Why is it they'd rather be dishonest than not tell the truth? Because truth is not valued. It's not put up there at the very top of the list of qualities you want to see in your kid. Please, with your children, make honesty that important that whatever they tell you, if it's the truth, that you will not punish them, nor will you scold them. If you find that your child has been missing school because they've been playing with their friends, and they come up and tell you, don't scold them or punish them. Say thank you that you've come and told me. If they have, say, been taking drugs or doing other sort of illegal things, if they come up and tell you, please don't punish them. Otherwise, they will never tell you. They come up to you, their parents, because they want help, not punishment. Punishment just stops them being honest. Punishment discourages honesty because we're scared of the consequences of telling the truth. Because once your kids tell you the truth, tell you the problems which they are facing, then of course it becomes our problem, not your kids' problem, the parents, the whole family's problem. And when you know the truth, and everybody works together, there's no problem which can't be solved. But when you don't know what's going on, and the kid can't come up to you to ask for help because they think they're going to be punished, you can understand why the problem festers and gets worse and worse and worse. So hopefully, please make a rule in your family. Tell your kids, son, daughter, whatever problem you get into in life, you can always come and tell me, and I will not punish you or scold you. I'm here to help solve the problems you feel. If your daughter found she's had teenage sex and has got pregnant, I know that sometimes that happens. It's real reality in life. It shouldn't happen, but it does in our modern world. If she's afraid of the parents or what they may say, you can't help them. But if they know that mum and dad, they may not agree with what I've done, but at least they will understand that I come to them not for punishment, but for help, then there's a huge amount which can be done. Unfortunately in life, honesty, truthfulness is not valued as much as it should be. That's why we should always have this amnesty. If someone tells the truth, then they really tell the truth. No punishment, but let's see if we can work together to solve the problem. And that's the same in a relationship, husband and wife. If your husband actually comes up and tells you honestly that he's had a relationship, an affair, if you scold him, he's going to do the same again next time, not tell you. He comes and tells you because he realizes he's making a mistake and he wants help to solve the problem. Don't scold him. Value honesty more than anything else. If your wife comes up and tells you she's a shopaholic and spent all your money, you can always give her plastic surgery. You know what plastic surgery means? Cutting up the credit cards. Now, but if she's honest to you, value that honesty. There's a problem there. And if there's a problem there and they're honest, no scolding. No, you stupid girl, you don't know how hard I work for that money. We can't afford it. We've got all these bills to pay. Don't go on like that, because people won't be honest with you anymore. So honesty is only encouraged when people aren't afraid to tell you what's going on. And honesty in a relationship should be valued more than anything else. So much so that you're willing to listen to anything, even stuff which is really hurtful, without punishing the other. Because honesty is one of the most important factors. It's almost a glue which keeps the relationship going. So with your kids, have that sense of honesty that they're your kids. They get criticized and punished in the world, but at least at home they have a loving parent who can understand that they are weak and they make mistakes, and they just want to be listened to and helped, not punished in life. And that's the same with you. The relationship you have with other people, you find, is exactly the same as your relationship you have with them yourself. I know that sometimes people, they have the problems with the person in the office. There's always one person in the office who's called the manager from hell. I don't know, there must have been many managers came from hell, because many people complain about them. There's always one person who just drives you crazy, gives you more work than you can do, always criticizes you, always stabs you in the back. You know that person, you may be even able to give me their name. But remember this, if that's how they treat you, that's also how they'll treat themselves. You only have to live with them 8 or 9 hours a day. They have to live with themselves 24 hours a day for the rest of their life. When you look at it that way, you don't get angry at those people who give you a hard time in the office. You have enormous compassion and sadness for them. As they treat you, that is how they treat themselves. Which is why if you learn to treat your partners well, your people you work in the office with well, you'll find you'll start to treat yourself well. In other words, straight away, honesty is so important. So you're true to yourself. You're not afraid of facing up to your weaknesses. Most people, they call it in psychology denial. Yeah, they've got a problem maybe with alcohol, but I don't. I'm not an alcoholic. I just have a little beer every now and again. But they can't walk home. They're so drunk. Oh, I'm not really cheating, you know, the tax system. I just put a bit aside. Everybody does that. They're being dishonest with themselves. Now, when you're honest with yourself, there's no problem you cannot solve. But you've got to be honest and face up to it first of all. So you find that people who are honest, you know, value honesty more than anything else, by allowing their wife, their husband, their kids to actually to say what's really true, and without punishing them, they will be honest with themselves. And that is a huge boost to your spiritual progress in life. Not only would they be honest to themselves, they'll also be very forgiving to themselves, as you're forgiving to your other friends. That relationship of listening to yourself with a bit of metta, loving kindness. So which means you'd never ever feel guilty if you've made a mistake. You forgive, no punishment. Because all guilt is punishing yourself for something you did. No one is perfect, we all make mistakes. And it's amazing when you ask a person what they feel guilty about, it's just tiny, trivial things. You know, one of the things I felt guilty about for years, that when I was a student, I did come from a very poor home. This was no exaggeration. I know many people say they were poor, but we really were poor. I remember my teacher come around when my father died just to check up I was okay. I said, why do you come around? He said, because I know you're very poor. And when the way he said that, I realized actually I was the poorest kid in the class. And because we were very, very, very poor, that during the vacations from university, I always had to get a job, you know, to supplement my money. And one job I got, actually this was before I went to university, waiting to go in there. One job I got was the worst job in the world, selling encyclopedias door to door. I actually did that. So knocking on people's door, and it was a children's encyclopedia, and it was rubbish. And I looked through it and I said, I'd never buy this, but you know, I had to sell it to get some money. And they trained me in this sales technique where the first thing you did when a knock on the door, if you got any young children, most people did, and are you interested in education? Which all parents are interested in education when you've got young kids. And I continued to ask these questions which were designed to make the parents feel they were only just one level below child molesters if they didn't buy this stupid encyclopedia. It was all built on guilt. You obviously don't love your children, and you're harming their educational advancement if you don't buy this very important encyclopedia. The problem was, I sold one. I went to this house, and there was this young couple, and they were just very sweet and soft. They just had given birth to their first child, you know, a girl, and they were just so so joyful of having a kid, you know, the first member of their family apart from themselves. They were just so happy. And when I came along, wanted to sell them encyclopedia, there was nothing they wouldn't buy at that time for their new child, even though it was rubbish, and so they brought it. And I never slept that night. I felt so guilty. You know, that was a young family. They needed money for other things, and they'd wasted their money on my stupid encyclopedia. And the following morning, I resigned. I gave up the job. I couldn't live with myself. If I would have remembered where that family lived, I would have gone back down there and paid them what they paid me. I felt so guilty. And you know, I kept that for years, feeling so terrible that there, you know, I was a salesman and I sold an encyclopedia which was worthless, and this poor couple, I imagined them going without food and a baby wearing rags because the total exaggeration. And then one evening, many years ago, I told that story as an example of how you feel guilty at our centre in Perth. And after the talk, somebody came up to me and they said, I have to speak with you, Ajahn Brahm. I said, why? He said, when you told that story, the hairs on my head went up. I was just really, really surprised, because I remember my parents telling me that when I was very young, a young student came to our house and sold us a children's encyclopedia. And I loved that encyclopedia. That was the best book I ever had. I carried it around with me. It was a beautiful book. And she said, it's too much of a coincidence. It could have been you, but it may have been. And I just needed to tell you, I love that book. I know that actually happened. I think, my goodness, all those things I thought I'd done wrong and I thought I was guilty for actually turned out to be okay after all. And I think I said last night that when I was about 19, I fell in love and my girlfriend dumped me. She's probably feeling guilty all these years. I should contact her and say, thank you, that was the most wonderful thing you did for me, so I could become a monk. If it wasn't for you, I'd now have wife suffering. So it's guilt is very, very strange. How we exaggerate the, you know, the punishment for something we did maybe years ago, which we don't really need to. So look, have a relationship with yourself which you can forgive and let things go. So it's not just a relationship with others. The same things which work with the relationships with a partner, which make it work, you're in peace and harmony with them, you can make peace and harmony with yourself. Forgive all your faults. It doesn't matter who's right and who's wrong. Just it's more important to be at peace with yourself. And this is what we learn in our practice of meditation. Often said that, and this is for the meditators, but those who are interested in meditation is the easiest thing in the world to do, but you just don't get it, which means people struggle and struggle and struggle. It's all another relationship problem. It's your relationship you have with this present moment, with what you're experiencing right now. That's all it is. So this moment, is it perfect? Doesn't matter, it's good enough. It's good enough to make peace with. So it does not matter what meditation your object you have. It does not matter whether you're watching the breath, whether you're scanning the feelings in your body, the sensations. It does not matter whether you're doing metta, loving kindness. It does not even matter whether you're falling asleep or whether you're dreaming of the boy who is just sitting next to you on the other side of the room or whatever. It does not matter what the content of your mind is in meditation. What's important in meditation is the relationship you have with what you're experiencing. For example, you're sleepy, you're dull. Do you hate that sleepiness? Are you upset with it? Are you embarrassed by it? What's your relationship with the dullness? Are you trying desperately to get rid of it? Because all of those relationships are dysfunctional. Instead, you make peace with your sleepiness, allowing it to be, letting it be, loving it. Dullness, the door of my heart is open to you, as you are. Remember that story behind the title of that book, which was advertised earlier, Open the Door of Your Heart, which has now been translated into about 22 languages. The latest is Bulgarian. A huge number of Bulgarian, Lithuanian, Polish, Czech, Slovakian, Slovenian, Portuguese, Italian, French, Danish, Dutch, and that's just the European languages, let alone the Asian ones. But in that story, Open the Door of Your Heart, it was my father who took me aside when I was a young man, about 14 or something, 13 maybe, turned around to me and said, "Son, whatever you do in your life, however you turn out, always remember the door of my heart will always be open to you. You're my son, and that's it. I will love you unconditionally." That was such an amazing thing to hear your father say. I did not have to live up to any standard. He would love me no matter what I turned out to be. You can imagine how that affected me. It inspired me and gave me something to live up to. And I try and do that to all of my friends, all of my disciples like you. I don't care what you do, how you turn out, especially those on this retreat, if you spend the rest of this 9 days sleeping or thinking sexual fantasies or talking when you're supposed to be having noble silence, the door of my heart will always be open to you. I'll always love you and care for you, no matter what you do to me. You know what I mean, that? It's lovely to mean that. Can you say that to your wife? To your husband, darling? Whatever you do, however you turn out, the door of my heart is always open to you, unconditionally. Wife, if you spend all my money, the door of my heart will always be open to you. We may not have a house, but we have a heart. I love you unconditionally. You see, there's something beautiful in that. So, especially in meditation, we say, mind, if you're asleep, if you're dreaming, whatever you do, mind, the door of my heart's open to you. I give you unconditional mindfulness. The important thing is unconditional, because it's your relationship you have with your mind. Is the essence of meditation. You have a beautiful relationship with your mind, you're at peace with it, you're kind with it, you're gentle with it. You find you are making the karma, the causes, for deep and blissful meditation in the near future. If you fight your sleepiness and dullness, is Buddhism about fighting? Did Buddha say go to war with your mind? Or did he say be compassionate and be gentle? Was a Buddha an aggressive person or a peaceful person? So what are you doing when you're meditating? Are you being a Buddhist when you're meditating with your eyes closed? No, you're not. You're fighting, feeling guilty, struggling. Some of you fighting a war and are very upset at yourself because you've been meditating a whole day and you're not enlightened yet. So see if you can change your relationship with your own mind and your meditation. Doesn't matter what you're experiencing right now, doesn't matter what it is, you can always make peace with it. You can always be kind, no matter what you're experiencing. And you can always be gentle. Which means you can always meditate. That's all you need to do. For the next 7 days, those on this retreat, that's all you need to do. Whatever you experience, be mindful of it, aware of this moment, make peace with it. Be so kind, open the door of your heart to this moment, and be so gentle with whatever you're experiencing. Be patient, and it will become still all by itself. Because you're being kind, you have this incredible sense of joy. Because you're being gentle, you don't cause your mind and your body any harm. Meditation is all about a skillful relationship you have with life. When you understand that, you understand how easy it is to meditate. And I will guarantee each one of you, if you make peace, be kind, be gentle, you'll get in such deep, blissful, insightful states of meditation so easily. You think, wow, now I know what the Buddha taught. Relationships, even with your own mind. Thank you for listening. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, now we can have some questions. Somebody wrote a question earlier, it's a meditation question, but I'll go through this as you're thinking about asking a question. So these questions are, I have read a lot about Samatha, Vipassana, Anapanasati, Samadhi and whatnot. There are so many views from so many teachers, monks and lay people. When it comes to Anapanasati, is there a difference between absorption, fixed concentration, one-pointedness and tranquility, stillness? It is important to recognize this and therefore avoid being stuck or going on the wrong path. Yeah, there are so many words and there are so many different objects of meditation. But as I mentioned earlier, the object of meditation is not important. What's really important is how you're relating to that object of meditation. As long as you're making peace, being kind, being gentle, being patient as well, then you're meditating. Samatha, Vipassana, all the same. Tranquility, stillness, one-pointedness, absorption, fixed concentration, forget about all of those. Just make peace, be kind, be gentle, and you'll go to those beautiful stages and you know what they are by yourself. So all the different ways of meditation, all the different objects, just like the different types of food you can eat. Doesn't matter what type of food you eat, whether it's rice, whether it's potatoes, whether it's bread, whether it's vegetarian, whether it's meat or fish, you put it in your mouth, it's different, but it comes out the other end, it all looks the same. Next question. Will the above influence us getting stuck in jhana? You're not. Jhana is the stages of letting go. You can't get stuck letting go. You're either stuck or you're letting go. You're either attached or you're free. So jhana is the states of freedom. That's why you can't get stuck in them. You're free. You're letting go. I'll say more about that later on. Please can you say more about the importance of nimitta to enter a jhana? Is it a prerequisite to the first jhanic state? This is when you get so still in your meditation. Your body disappears. You can't feel your legs, or your hands, or your head. You can't feel anything, even the breath disappears. You can't hear any sounds. Your 5 senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching are gone. In their place, you're left with the sixth sense, the mind. When that first appears, it's mostly seen or experienced by most people as this beautiful light in the mind called the nimitta. That's just how it appears for most people. So everything else has disappeared and all you've got left is the mind. That appears as this beautiful nimitta. The reason it is a prerequisite, because if the jhanas are where the five senses completely go, this is the prerequisite, the sign which happens before the jhanas occur. But you don't make this happen. This is what happens when you let things go. When you're making peace, you're being kind, being gentle, this is what happens. But if you interfere, and if you try and make this happen, it's never ever going to happen. You have to get out of the way, let go, be peace, and stop interfering. Otherwise, things never get still. In the jhana, can we feel our body aware of someone touching us? Can we still hold some thoughts? No, no, no. That's why in the jhana states you can't feel anything at all. So if somebody picks you up and takes you to your room and lays you down, you will not know. This is the classic experience, one of the tales of one of my students in Perth. He was an Australian guy. He would only usually meditate for 40 minutes. But one Sunday afternoon, there was nothing on the TV. It's one of the reasons why there's so many people here for the talk this evening. There can be nothing on TV tonight. So, he came. He went to his bedroom, told his wife, I'm just going to meditate for about 40 minutes or an hour. After an hour and a half, he hadn't come out of his room. So his wife went into the room to check on him. And there he was, sitting perfectly still. Too still. Because she couldn't see his chest go up and down. She couldn't see him breathing. And so she got so scared. She rang 000, which is like 999 in UK. What's the emergency number in Malaysia? 999. I ring in 999. And the ambulance came around in 10 minutes with the sirens wailing. Making a huge noise, and these ambulance men rushed into the bedroom to check his pulse. They could find no pulse. So they put him straight in the stretcher and rushed him with all of the sirens going through all the red lights if it was safe, rushing him to the emergency room of the local hospital. He wasn't breathing, no pulse. This was dangerous, like a heart attack, or even worse, a stroke. Who knows what happened to him? And they put him through into the emergency room, and straight away they strapped on the first of all the ECG. This was an emergency. They put on the ECG. Ding, 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 ding. Flatline emergency. Apparently, the ECG doesn't go ding, 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 ding. I made that up because it makes the story more exciting. Ding, 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 ding. But it was a flat line. So they put on the EEG to see if his brain was working. Another flat line. Ding, 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 ding. Emergency, brain dead. So there he was in hospital. His wife accompanied him. She told me the story. Flat line, ECG and EEG. He was dead. They never took him down to the morgue, which was a very good thing. If they had, when he came out of his meditation and woke up, he would have probably scared the attendants so much there would be two more dead people. The reason they never took him down to the morgue was because, as luck would have it, that evening, the doctor on duty was actually from India. And Indian people, that they've got more experience about meditation, because as many yogis, swamis, apparently can actually suspend their life functions. And this doctor thought, my goodness, this guy was meditating. Maybe he's one of these. who suspended his life function. So they decide to put on the defibrillators, these pads on your chest through which they pass an electric shock to try and stimulate your heart into moving. You've seen that on the movies or on the TV. It's such a violent shock that you actually lift a couple of centimeters off the stretcher. According to his wife, many, many times I did that. And nothing was working. He kept on trying though, but he was dead. No heartbeat, no brain. Until he decided, so he told me, he was perfectly aware all the time, but he could not feel his body. Blissed out, a happiness which was more than he'd ever felt ever before. Until he decided to come out of his meditation, opened his eyes, he bent up, beep, beep, beep. Both monitors showed normal brain function and normal heart function. He was perfectly okay. The doctor gave him a thorough checkup, could find nothing wrong with him at all, so he walked home. He said throughout the whole experience, he was perfectly awake, fully mindful, but mindful of not of his body, but deep inside, of a bliss, of a happiness, beyond comprehension. And he said the only unpleasant part of the whole experience, the only thing which stopped him wanting to do it ever again, was the extreme scolding he got from his wife. Don't you ever, ever do that again. Now that's a true story. A weird story, because the fellow got into this by chance. He'd never been able to do it again. But he got into a jhana, a typical jhana experience. And it was only because his wife overreacted that they took him to hospital. He could hear none of the sounds. He could feel not even the electric shocks on his chest. And that's a sign that that fellow was in a deep trance. That answers the question, this is what happens. But you don't have to worry, you're perfectly safe. You just do not die. I know other monks, this was in the suttas, there was one monk meditating in a forest and got into a deep jhana. And two villagers came by, they were both Buddhists, they saw this monk. They thought, my goodness, he's dead. And being Buddhists, they thought it was not a respectful thing to leave a dead monk in the forest to get eaten by animals. Even though they were busy, it was in the forest, so it wouldn't take them that long to collect some wood to build a funeral pyre. And they put the monk on top, and they lit the wood. And once the fire was well established, they realized the fire would do the rest. They were busy, so they went off to do whatever they were doing in the forest. So they cremated him. You can imagine, this is in the suttas, in the Majjhima Nikaya. You can imagine their surprise when the next morning he came into their village on arms round. If you get into these jhanas and they cremate you, you come out the oven whole. You can't be burnt. Even this one monk, who I knew, he was from Indonesia. He told me how he went into the jungle in Java and went to do some meditation. He explained what happened to him. He said it was like this huge light, like a star came towards him, and he merged with the star. That's like a nimitta. And he doesn't know how many days he was meditating in the jungle, but when he came out of his meditation, the jungle looked a lot different because there had been a flood. He asked the villagers, and yes, where he was sitting was submerged in many meters of water. He was actually underwater for days. But because in deep meditation, he was perfectly okay. So don't worry, you're perfectly safe. I guarantee that. Money back guarantee. How long will first jhana last? Sometimes short, sometimes long. It really depends on how much letting go. It could be half an hour, it could be many hours. I've read many comments about the Visuddhimagga. In your opinion, is it worthwhile reading material? Some of the Visuddhimagga is okay, some are not okay, but the one bit I really like is this poem, which I've often actually mentioned. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. In other words, if you're doing the meditation, if you're travelling, if you're driving the car, there's no path for you. You have to get out of the way and disappear. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Okay, there we go. So let's have some more questions. No, there's another meditation question, but I'll do that tomorrow. This is other questions on relationships. I'll put this on the floor, so hopefully. And here's another question here. When we seek forgiveness too often, could we give in a sacrifice ourselves to the other party? And when this happens, will we soon burn up and the relationship might break? Please enlighten us. Okay, this is, if you give forgiveness too often, will the other person take advantage of you? Is that you just burning yourself up, and it's, you know, not about us anymore, it's about me forgiving my partner? And of course it does, because when we do forgiveness, we also have to do another part, not just forgiving, but encouraging the sort of behavior we want to see in our partner. So we forgive their faults, but we need to do more than that. We have to encourage their goodness. I said last night, one of the great ways of encouraging goodness is praise. I read this article in a medical journal which somebody said to me, there was some disease amongst children where they just cannot keep their food down. Whatever you feed them, they vomit it up again. And so they had this therapy group for such a group of children, I think it was in the UK. And they solved the problem in this way. They would have a group of children with their parents and the nurses and other carers. And when a child managed to keep the food down for, I think, 3 minutes, they would have a party. They'd get out the balloons, they would start dancing around, they'd put on some favourite music, and this kid was the centre of celebrations. And they went over the top celebrating this kid keeping the food down for 3 minutes. Because of that praise, that positive reinforcement, the child started keeping the food down longer and longer and longer. Because we all want praise, we always want to be the cause of happiness. And it was using that psychological force inside each one of us to please others, to make them happy, which actually encouraged them to overcome that sort of illness. It was a beautiful therapy. And it's the same with your husband. If he comes home early, throw a party. Go over the top. Know that he's pleased you and pleased many other people. Whatever else it is. There's another article someone sent me, and it was a brilliant woman. She was doing a psychology degree. Then it was a PhD. So she had to get some sort of research project. So she chose to go to one of these these water parks, where they train dolphins to perform tricks. So she went there to find out the psychology of the trainers. How you get these dolphins to jump through hoops, you know, to play sort of water polo or soccer or something in the pool. How do you train dolphins to do this? And she noticed the way you train them is, you never punish the dolphin. If they don't do the trick, you never hit them with a stick or scold them or anything. Whenever they make a mistake, it's totally forgiven. But whenever they jump 1 inch higher, you throw them a fish. You give them a reward. Another inch higher, they get another fish. And it's reward, 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 which is how you train the dolphins. And when she saw this, she got a great insight. She said, I think I can use this same technique, how they train dolphins, on my husband. So she wrote this incredible, powerful paper on how to train husbands. And she got her PhD. And it was a very famous paper, which is why I read it. So this is actually how you train your husbands. If he does anything wrong, don't punish him, don't scold him, that doesn't work. But when he does something which you want him to do more often, throw him a fish. Don't throw a fish at him, don't hit him with a fish. Which is only a metaphor, in other words, give him a reward. And it's amazing just how you can train people with that positive reinforcement. The forgiveness is forgiving the faults, but reinforcing the good behavior by some sort of reward, some sort of throwing a fish. And she said actually how it happened. She gave this example that every morning when they were both getting ready to work, her husband would always be mislaying things. "Where did I put my tie, darling?" And before, she'd always stop what she was doing to find her husband's tie. And that really sort of made her fed up. She had enough to do in the morning without looking for where this stupid husband put his clothes. So she decided to try and train her husband out of this. So it meant whenever he was asking, "Darling, darling, where did I put my tie?" she didn't scold him, she just totally ignored him and carried on with her jobs. So he had to find it himself. And when he found his tie, she went up to him and gave him a big hug and kiss. "Oh, well done, darling." Which he liked. And he said it only took about a month, 6 weeks. And he said, "Now he never asks me, where is my tie, darling? He always finds it for himself. He's been trained just like the dolphins." So that's what we mean by forgiveness. It's not just forgiving your husband, but encouraging the positive qualities as well. And that's actually how it works. Okay. Here you go. If parents do not value truth, should the child still tell the truth? If he tells the truth, the child will get scolded. So what should he do? Thanks. The child is in a bind. He's in a difficult situation. He wants to tell the truth. He wants to get help from his parents, because that's what telling the truth is. Saying, "Look, I'm in a mess. I'm in trouble at school, or trouble with the police, or you know, all sorts of trouble. I've made a big mistake." You want to tell the parents to try and get some help from them. They're wiser, wealthier, or whatever. And if they're afraid of being scolded, of course, they'll think twice about asking you. So it really depends on what the problem is. Sometimes you've got no choice. You know, you're going to get scolded, but it's worthwhile getting your parents' help. But the reason I told this today is, please, you parents, please, if your kid is in trouble, or actually before they get into trouble, let them know that you value honesty so much that way that you feel you can tell your parents anything, and they will understand you're not a perfect kid. This is, they weren't perfect parents. They made mistakes too. And that way, you're opening the possibility to help your kid when it's really, really important. And there are many kids, instead of going to their parents, they come to me. It's like, "I can't tell my parents this. Like, girls, I got pregnant. Can you please help me tell? I'm just so afraid of what my mum and dad would say." I think that's such a shame that you have to go through me to tell your parents you made a big mistake. Or, you know, "I've got in trouble, I've been with some friends and I've got in trouble with the police. I'm so afraid of telling my dad and what he might say." So that's, you know, sometimes I come to the mic and I just go to the parents and say, "Look, your kid's in trouble. But I'm not going to tell you what he's done until you promise me you're not going to punish him." And so I use my influence on the parents. Because otherwise it shouldn't actually be that way. You should have enough love and responsibility for your kids. So to tell them, "Look, you can tell me anything, son, daughter, anything. And I will try and encourage you to be a good person, but I won't scold you, so don't be afraid." Okay, got some more questions? I'm just putting one on the floor so I know which ones I've answered. Why are people so quick to judge other people? I know it is just an opinion, not necessarily true, but sometimes it really gets to me. How can I handle it better? Don't believe what other people say about you. It's hard for me to know about me. Let alone it's impossible for other people to know what you're up to. So when people judge you, just again, they usually judge you by words. And that's again, I said yesterday, that's what you've got two ears for. One to go in and one to go out. So if it's nice words, I always keep the nice words. If they say, "I jump on you, such a wonderful monk." When I hear that, I always put one hand over my ear so it stops inside. When they say, "Ajahn Brahm, you're the most stupid monk I've ever met in my whole life, you tell terrible jokes," then I allow that to go right through and I don't keep it. So I only keep the good stuff, not the bad stuff. Okay, you can do that. You've got a choice, and it's much better for you. So people judging others, I can't judge other people. I can't judge you. All of you who come into the interview room over the next 7 days, all of you who've been to interviews in other retreats I've given in the world, sometimes you may have noticed that you go in there and you say, oh, I've been sleeping all the time, and I say, very good. You go in there and you say, my meditation's hopeless, and I say, very good. You go in there and said that, you know, actually that I haven't really been meditating at all, I've just been going and looking at the TV or whatever, and I say, very good. You say, I've just got into jhana and became enlightened, I say, very good. I will not judge you. And the reason I don't judge you is because it does make no sense at all to judge another person. In the same way that when I was at school, I never compared the kids in grade 1 with the kids in grade 12. Who was the best kids? Just because they were in grade 12 didn't mean they were better children. Yeah, they knew more, and they were more skilled, but it didn't mean they were better, because they'd only just started school. So how can you compare them? The same way I can't compare any one of you. That's why you can't judge them. So please don't be a person who judges others. And then you won't be a person who judges yourself. Instead you say to yourself, the door of my heart's open to me. Whatever I might be, and I'm not quite sure what that is. But whatever it is, I allow myself in. I'm at peace with myself. So that's why people judge, they're so quick to judge other people because they judge themselves. And when they judge other people, it's usually putting them down, because if you put somebody else down, that makes you higher. It's just ego. But when you believe that, it does really get to you. So again, hang around with good people, with kind people who just love you for who you are. When you make a mistake, they just laugh with you instead of criticizing you. In relationships, how should we balance caring for us and not being too attached? Look, if you really want to become enlightened, then having a relationship is a danger for attachment. But you can still care without being attached. And this is how you do it. I don't know if I said this one in the simile of the cup with the crack. Did I say that yesterday? I think that must have been Friday in Perth before I came here. See this cup here? It's actually got a crack in it. Can you see the crack? Actually, you can't see it because it's microscopic. But it's there. And you know, one day that crack will open up and this ceramic cup will shatter and break and be no more. It's fragile. If I drop this, if I kick it, if I don't look after it, if I don't care for it, that crack will open up. It's fragile. If this cup was plastic, I wouldn't need to care for it. I could kick it around, drop it, because it's plastic and unbreakable. It's because it's fragile, because it won't last, that is why I must care. In a relationship, we all know it's fragile. You know, many other people have got divorced. Many other people have had arguments and they've separated. You know your relationship is very fragile. Even if it doesn't separate because of arguments or differences, eventually death will separate it. So because our relationships are fragile and temporary, that is why we must care. If we were going to live forever, we would need to care for our body. If we were always going to be together, we would need to care for each other. Because we're going to be separated, that is why we must care. That's not being attached, because we know there's a crack in it. So when this does break, you know, I expected that. But while the cup has been intact, I've had many, many wonderful glasses of water. Thank you, cup. We've had a great time together. I appreciate all the great relationship we've had. So when your partner disappears, either in death or they decide to go somewhere else. We realize I expected that to happen. One day it must happen. We've had such a wonderful time together. Thank you so much for being my friend. That way we can care without being attached. And I'm being honest, I care for each one of you in this room. But when I leave, 1 week from today, I will not carry any of you with me to Penang. When we're together, we care. When it's time to go, what a great time we've had. See you next time. That's how we can care without being attached. And how should we practice letting go while in relationships? Let go of all the stupid stuff and keep all the wise stuff. Let go of all the bad words and keep all the beautiful words. Let go of all the painful memories and keep the happy ones. So all the things which went wrong in the last year of your relationship, don't linger on that. Don't cherish that. As I said yesterday, you don't keep photographs of your trash cans. Maybe you keep photographs of the garden. You don't keep photographs of the time when you're in hospital. You don't have a photograph of when you're at work. You have a photograph of when you're on holiday. How many of you take your cameras when you go to work on a Monday morning? But when you go on holiday or on retreat, then you take your cameras. So keep the memories of the happy moments in your relationship and let go of the painful memories. Next question. How can I relieve my inner pain due to separation? It's only through meditation. Thank you. It's through meditation and also through wisdom. You've been separated from somebody. When I was separated from my father, because he died, I never felt sadness. It's amazing, sort of, I don't know where I got these feelings from. At least I didn't know at the time. Obviously, it's from previous lives. But when my father died, I was only 16. It was strange. I never felt sad, even though I loved my father very much. I never cried, not once, either at his funeral or afterwards. And it really surprised me. What's wrong with me? Why don't I feel sad when someone I loved very, very much suddenly died after only 16 years of being with him? And of course, it was such a strange feeling that I remembered it when I became a monk. When I was wise enough to reflect, I started thinking, what was going on at that time? Why didn't I feel sad? Why didn't I shed a tear? And I understood my emotion. I understood it so clearly. But I recognized it was similar to another emotion which I'd felt as a young man. And when I noticed the similarity of the feeling I felt on my father's death with this other occasion, I had the simile of the concert. The young man growing up in London, I loved music. And I went to see the Rolling Stones when I was only 11. And I was very angry at the girls, because they were screaming so loudly I could hear no music at all. The 60s. I remember going, I don't know if any of you like rock music, I went to this one concert, 2 hours of The Doors, followed by 2 hours of Jefferson Airplane, another 2 hours of The Doors, and another 2 hours of Jefferson Airplane. For people who love rock music, that makes them salivate. That was really an amazing concert. I remember going with my brother to a pub in the north of London to hear a band play. And only 6 of us turned up. My brother and I were 2 of those 6. And I thought the band wouldn't play, but they gave us like a private performance. The lead singer is very famous now. He's called Rod Stewart. So they had like a private concert by these guys. So I love those clubs, concert halls and pubs when I was young, where I used to sort of listen to great music. But I also remembered that when the concert was about to finish, they would all stand up, clap and shout for more. It's called the encore. Same thing happens today. I haven't been to a concert in 36 years, but apparently they still have the encores. when the band finishes, you shout, ask for more, and they do a little bit more. But then the encore has to come to an end. The band has to go home, and so did I. And I always remember once the concert had finished, and I knew there was no likelihood I'd ever hear such a band or orchestra again. When I walked out of those concert halls into the wet, dark, cold London night, knowing that the concert was well and truly over, never once did I feel sad. I never cried at the end of a great concert. The emotion I felt walking out of those concert halls or pubs or clubs was precisely the emotion I felt at my father's death. What a great performance that was. What a great time we had together. There was an encore, two or three encores, when we thought my father was dying, but he pulled through. But eventually, the encore was over. He died. What a great performance that was. I would not have missed that for the world. Thank you, Father. Not sadness, but gratitude. That's how we look at separation. What a great time we've had together. All the great memories we've shared. It's over now. But never let the ending, never let the ending take away all the wonderful times and memories you had in between. That way the separation is a bit sour, but not enough to take away the sweetness of all your happy memories. Okay, that's, I think, we've got some more questions that keep coming in. Very good. Put on four. Next question. We are living in this world, I agree with that, of unless you're an alien. Is any people from outer space here? People ask me that, are there aliens? You go to Heathrow Airport and you'll find out there is actually an entry point for aliens. They got it down there, EU citizens and aliens. When I first went to Heathrow and I saw that, I thought that's very interesting. I was waiting to see people with antennas and appendages go through that gate in the immigration at Heathrow Airport. They call them aliens. Anyway, we're living in this world of consumerism and capitalism where mass media and advertisements are used to stimulate the emotions and desires of the public that they become addicted and attached. Is there a mechanism to awake them from these manipulations of business? Yeah, I mean, when you go and watch these advertisements on TV or even just on the tollways going from KLIA, I don't know how many advertisements there were on these big billboards. We are bombarded with advertisements to consume. And so we need to rebrainwash ourselves by coming to the temple. And if you come into the temple, we don't advertise anything over here. It's all for free. This is actually the antithesis of materialism. I'm telling you to live more simply. How much do you need? How many shoes do you have? Compare the number of shoes to how many feet you have. Can you see there's a disconnect there? So actually you can live more simply. And people who say, if Ajahn Brahm keeps on talking like this, the economy will go down. And we'll all go bust. And it's not like that. If you can live more simply, much of the wealth of our nations is going to fix up the problems caused by mass consumerism. The health problems, because people are so stressed out, working so hard to pay for the things they don't need anyway. That's why we have huge hospitals, where we have lots of psychological problems, which we spend heaps of money fixing. We could save a lot of money and be sustainable if we had less desires. So look, this type of teaching is a teaching whose time has come. Simplicity. Because how much are we consumed? We're just consuming our planet at a rate which means we'll have nothing left for our kids. There'll be big trouble. So this is not a thing you can wait for some conference in Cancun to solve. We have to act ourselves to see if we can live more simply, consume less, make more things last, have less pairs of shoes, less clothes, and use less. And then instead of being a consumer, which just creates more problems for ourselves and others, you will find that you can retire much younger with more money in the bank because you haven't spent it on such stupid things. How big a house do you want? Sometimes people like to buy big houses, you know, in good suburbs. Why? Just to show off to your neighbors and friends. See how good I am. I'm wealthy and rich. I prefer small houses. As I said yesterday, in a big house, your son has one room, your daughter has another room, your wife has her room, your husband has another room, your grandma has another room. You never meet each other. Your house separates your family. In a small house, you sleep in the same room, you're always running into each other, you can't avoid each other, which means you're a family. You learn how to live and love each other. Many of you more elderly people here grew up in a house like that. My little apartment where we grew up, you couldn't escape from my brother, my mum and my dad. There's no escape, we're just in a small apartment. That's how we learned to love each other. But if I was in my own room, I could just go into seclusion. I never learned the skill of learning to share space with another human being. Big houses mean big problems. And that's only the social problem, let alone the amount of money you have to pay to buy such things. Now the credit crunch, where did that come from? From people building big houses which they didn't need anyway, just because they thought it was investment. And the prices went down, down, down. So look, have small houses, even if you can afford a big house. Buy a small one, especially if you have a family, so you can be together. You've got no place to run to. You have to live together. It also means you don't have to have such big debt. So, this is against consumerism, but it creates a much more socially harmonious society. And it much more fulfillment. You find you can get much more happiness, not out of how much you own, but how much you share. So that's my... it's not Marxism, it's not consumerism, it's Buddhism. Okay, any questions from the floor? Because the paper questions have run out now. Okay, I'll do this. There's a meditation question, but I'll do that tomorrow morning. So, any questions from the floor about consumerism? Yes, or whatever, yes. Yeah, I don't, because I'm only here for a short time and spending most of this time doing meditation, but it's a great idea. So I know there's many Buddhist societies communities who are represented here today. So why not Triple Gem Center, organize a forgiveness ceremony? Okay. Oh, please forgive me for not coming. I'm so caught up with so many other things, going here, going there, many, many countries, and I've got to look after my own place back in Perth, which people sometimes, I go back to my monastery and the monks say, "Who are you?" No, I'm exaggerating, but it's getting close to that. So that, no, it's, you can do a forgiveness ceremony yourselves, and it's a beautiful thing to do. So just get everybody up together, you know, and get some sort of gifts. If you, you know, if it's somebody who's died, you want to ask forgiveness, give a little gift of flowers, incense to the Buddha statue. And just, you know, say, you know, my wife isn't dead. There's many, many things I should have said which I didn't say to you. Things which I did which I shouldn't have done. I ask your forgiveness. Whatever it is, do it in your own words. You can do a ceremony, and it's very, very beautiful to do. So you can really let go of the past. It's a great idea. And I really apologize that my schedule, as Eng Chai knows, over the next 7 days is chock-a-block with things. So can't do it this time, but great idea to do next time. I often do that at funeral services, to have a forgiveness ceremony. And yeah, these are sometimes Westerners who've never done such a thing before. And it's really, really moving. I just say, because sometimes people come to the funeral and they bring back a lot of baggage. You know, what that person has done. You know, and they're not all, even the family members, they have to come because that's your father or that's your brother. There's a lot of baggage in the family. It's great, I say, okay, now you're going to close your eyes and imagine that person who's in the casket, who's dead. And say to them, as if they were right in front of you, if there's anything which I have done in the time I've known you, which has hurt you or irritated you, deliberate or just by accident, I really ask your forgiveness and I mean it. Please forgive me. Can you imagine what the person would say? They would smile, always smile, and say, yes. You know, you're my brother, and I love you. But if there's anything I've done as well which may have harmed or hurt you, I'm dead now, but I ask your forgiveness too. Let all the pain of the past go no further. Let us love each other as family members should. And get people really moved. So much so, the last time I did that service, the funeral director came up to me afterwards and said, this is the funeral director, the one who organises the funeral ceremonies. He said, that's the best funeral I've ever been to. I want to book you for my funeral. And I said, you have to wait until you die first. That's what they did. So it's actually praise from the professionals. So it's a great idea, and I wish I had time, it'd be a beautiful thing to do. But maybe someone can actually take them up and do one of those things at the Old Buddhist Center or the Triple Gem Center. I know the BTF is represented here today. Many other sort of Buddhist groups around PJ or KL or in the Klang Valley. Do it. It's a great thing to do. Yes. How can I stop rebounding?
Demanding.
Demanding. From your partner, buddy. Because after a while, you, it doesn't matter how much you demand from your partner, you don't get it anyway. So you give up. And instead, you use Buddhist psychology. So you can always get what you want if you know how to get it. So we use Buddhist psychology with your partner. And this is, I'm going to tell you the trick now. If your partner's here, it won't work because they'll suss you out. But if your partner's not here, then this is going to help you get whatever you want in your marriage. This story came when I was the second monk in the monastery up in Australia. And the senior monk at the time, he was a very dominant figure. He always had to be in charge. So if I argued with him, he'd always win. So I had to use my psychology to be sneaky. So I could get what I wanted without him knowing. And this is what I did. We were about to build a hut somewhere. So I made the suggestion to him, said, why don't we build a hut on the hill over there? Because I made the suggestion, he said, no, that's a stupid idea. That won't work. Don't be ridiculous. Now, it's only because I said it, he would say no. He You know what husbands are like, wives are like? Sometimes just because you say it, on principle they say no. But I was wise enough. I said, okay, I let it go immediately. I drop it. Because I knew the seed had been planted. And then maybe 2 weeks I'd reinforce it. When I thought, and I was actually had to be very careful, when I was sure he'd forgotten what I said 2 weeks ago, I'd say it to him again. You know, we have to build a hut. Why don't we build a hut on the hill over there? And he repeats, that's a stupid idea. It's ridiculous. It won't work. Okay. 2 times was usually all that was needed. At most, 3 times. And then, a couple of weeks afterwards, I'd reminded him last time. I'd be walking with him. And he'd say, I've suddenly had an idea. Why don't we build that hut on the hill over there? And I'd say, that's a good idea of yours. Yeah, let's do it. Because it's important that it had to be his idea. But I know I'd put the seed in. And if it really was a good idea, it would stay in his subconscious. It would work its way through the brain. And because it really was a good idea, I knew it was a good idea, the only barrier was it had to be his idea before it became approved. And so when it came through, he actually thought it was his idea, but it was my idea. I knew it was my idea, but I never told him. And that way I got my own way. So, say you need a new dress. So you ask your husband, I need a new dress. You've got enough dresses. And how many more dresses do you need? And we can't afford it. You say, oh yeah, okay darling. Shut up, don't argue. It spoils the process. Wait for another week or two, when you think he's forgotten it. They say, oh darling, why don't I get a new dress? You say, yeah, you've got enough dresses, too many, we can't afford it. It's hard economic times, stop it. Okay, darling. And you'll be amazed. A couple of weeks later, he said, darling, I think you need a new dress. Oh, thank you, darling, you're such a kind husband. You're so thoughtful. You know, it works. It's really good. So you try that. Yeah. Meditation, yeah. You say to your mind, oh, I want to get jhana. Say, no, you can't get jhana. I haven't meditated long enough yet. Say, okay. So you just put the seed in and see what happens. If it's a good idea, it works. It's actually how you influence people. If you want a raise at work, don't go banging on your boss's door, I need a raise, I really deserve it. Put the idea in his head. Say, no boss, I really work hard and I do much more work than other people and I really contribute a lot to this company. Can I have a raise? No, we can't afford it. Difficult times. Okay. You put the seed in. And then, worse, think about it. Maybe reinforce it maybe once, but wait for a while till you're sure he's forgotten what you said. If he's got a good memory, you'll be in trouble. Yes. Yeah, it has to be us. So it has to be worthwhile for both parties to forgive. That's especially in a marriage. Because you know you have to forgive. Do you really want to keep living with that pain for any more time? So the thing to do is to bring your enemy to talk such as this. When you say, we're having a talk tomorrow, please bring your friends. No, it's not your friends needed, bring your enemies next time to the talk. So actually they learn this. And there's something inspiring with forgiveness because it hurts both sides. You know, when there's pain. But when there's actually forgiveness, there's a great sense of freedom. There's something very noble and inspiring and holy in forgiveness. That people of all religions recognize that, and of no religions, they recognize this as something very beautiful and sacred. You have to inspire people to accept forgiveness. So it needs marketing. And then they do it. And they think, yeah, I'm going to give forgiveness. We've had too much problems. It hurts both of us, and I don't want to see our family suffer any longer. And sometimes it is at those funeral services. Many times I go to funeral services, and because like the father who's died, sometimes sisters who've had arguments for years, who have refused to talk to each other for sort of 10, 15 years, when they come, they have to come to their father's funeral. They sit separated from each other because they still have bad feelings. They hear this forgiveness ceremony. And they look at each other and say, for my father who's now died, I'm going to forgive you, sister. The sister says, yeah, for dad, we'll forgive. They need to be inspired by something really greater than themselves. So that's how forgiveness happens. Inspiration. For a greater purpose of keeping the hurt. Does that make any sense? Very good. That must mean the end of the session. The three sadhus, dog star.